Hi, I'm Stacy, and the workshop is about cooperative economics, about different kinds of cooperative models for organizing the economy. And I'm gonna hopefully make this a lot more participatory. I don't do well at lecturing very much, so I'm gonna ask you guys to. What I'm going to try and do is just kind of guide us all through the process of, like, thinking about these things, because I think that there's a lot more questions here than answers. So what I'm going to do is start with the easy part, which is always the easy part, the part about what we don't like about the present system of capitalism and how economics is organized right now. And kind of, like, I'm going to ask you all to throw out, you know, a list of the items that we don't like about capitalism, and then that's going to become a kind of way for us to evaluate our alternative models. And we're going to, you know, kind of look at what kind of problems worker ownership solves, what kind of problems community ownership solves, and different sorts of things. And I'm going to give away the ending right away and say that I'm pretty sure that we're going to decide that no single model of ownership is going to, you know, create the thing that we want. So, just so you know, that's not where I'm trying to go with this, and I don't think you guys would like that either. But where I'm going to want to end up going with it is to try and figure out what are the good things we can take from the good parts, what are the bad, how can we combine all these things, and what combination of things will give us an economy that we like and feel good about. So, the other thing is that I hope that I don't sound like I've made up my minds about a lot of things. Like, I have really strong opinions about some things, but for me, a lot of this is about questions. And so sometimes when I say things just to either, like, to try on the idea or to be kind of devil's advocate and stuff. And if I say something, it doesn't necessarily mean I believe it really strongly. It might just be for the purpose of discussion. Okay, so I'm not going to lecture, and I'm actually going to ask you guys to start. And what I want to know is the kind of, like, features of capitalism, the details about why it hurts people, why we don't want it, what is it doing wrong. And I think that we can kind of, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. I think it's things that we all know, but I just want to get them kind of out on the table. So does anyone want to give me one?
The distribution of wealth is very uneven and allows the people in power to gain wealth and the people with wealth to gain power.
Okay.
And marginalizes the poor.
Right. And when some people have wealth and some others don't, we don't like that because...
Because, it produces a imbalanced power structure in society, and also, often leaves some people, you know, half starving and working undesirable jobs at long hours, and while other people have lots of privilege and gets into classist society.
Okay. So it limits opportunities, it creates a system of exploitation, too. What are other parts?
It makes it so that even though there could be enough, like, for example, food or housing or whatever, you can take sort of anything that people need to live, there could be enough of that, but it just makes it so that some people just can't have, it's illogical, you know, some people just can't have it because it turns things that, it makes things owned by particular people, and it allows people to use things that are meant to be used for profit rather than for what they're supposed to be for. So it commodifies things, you know, and that's okay. Bad because it keeps people from having what they need.
Yeah. Yeah, both of those things. So, I mean, it commodifies it. It like makes people pay for things and exchange things for money that really should be given freely for one thing, but it also rations things for people who are able to pay for them, right? What about, like, growth? I mean, capitalism inherently needs to grow to survive, and the damage that growth can do to the world. Okay. I think we pretty... I mean, I want you to keep all of these kinds of things in mind, because we're going to talk about them really specifically. So my list that I had was exploitation of workers, the tendency towards growth, and the growth that gobbles up resources, you know, destroying the environment, rationing products to people who can afford to pay for them, and commodification of things that should be given freely. And I think that, you know, the fundamental cause of all these things, the institution that causes it is the ownership by private people of wealth, and their motivation towards wanting to make a profit for themselves is what, I mean, is kind of the fundamental idea, their motivation behind how they act in the economy and how they use their resources. Do you think that's a fair thing to say? Okay. So I think if the primary things that we need to worry about are private ownership and the motivation of the people who are owners as private actors, and that they're motivated to act in their own interests, then when we think about different models, we think about who owns the resources and what are their motives for acting with the resources that they have. And so the three kind of models that I want to look at are ownership by workers, ownership by customers or consumers, and ownership by the community at large. And I have a handout about that. So, and my handout, I should say, I'm a very visually oriented person, right? And if you are too, then this will probably work out for you. If you're not, you can ignore it. Because we'll talk it through, too. It's pretty rough. But what it says, basically, is that, you know, of all the... I call it... There's... on the handout, I call it ownership by nobody, ownership by somebody, and ownership by everybody, is the way that I think about it. And ownership by nobody is what we've got now. That things... What we've got... Oh, the little dots are people. The dots are people, and so what we have is like a system of, in corporate capitalism, we have a system of shareholders, and so nobody special owns the place that makes what we've got, right? It's just random people who have no relation to the business at all. They're not necessarily customers, they're not necessarily workers in that industry or in that company. They only want to make a profit, and they put the money in order to make a profit, and that's it. So ownership by somebody is ownership by a group of people with a specific relationship to it. And the two that I think about are worker ownership and customer ownership. So each one kind of has a claim on what's going on in the business, you know, that the business is doing something for them. And worker ownership, you know, the motive of workers who own their own business is mostly to employ themselves and to employ themselves in an environment that is respectful to them and where they have control over their work. That's the motive for how they act. And for customer ownership, it's to provide something that those people want to buy. And so they collectivize their resources to try and get what they want for themselves, and the motive is to provide a product. And then community ownership is this ownership by everybody idea, that that in a community, everybody owns the resources together and decides on them together, regardless of who's a worker and who's a consumer and who actually uses the products. And I have examples of these, just to make it a little more concrete. For worker ownership, it's pretty easy. There's a lot of obvious examples, like the appliance factories in Mondragon are kind of the best known ones. But there's a lot of forms of worker ownership, like there's now employee stock ownership plans, which means that a lot of people are, at least in a financial sense, the owners of their employer. United Airlines has or did have a model like this, and so theoretically they were the owners of their employer, even though they didn't have any democratic control over it. But there are, in Boston, where I live, there's the best example that I know is a community builders cooperative, which is a construction company. They run on a consensus model, and they have a flat wage scale, and they're a very involved and democratic worker-owned company. So consumer ownership is like, can be a lot of different things. You can have a company that's owned by individuals, like a food co-op, owned by individual customers, or you can have consumer co-ops that are owned by other businesses or other co-ops. These are usually marketing co-ops and agricultural co-ops. Like Ace and True Value Hardware brands are cooperatives that are, it's a cooperative, those are both cooperative marketing companies that are owned by the individual hardware store owners who participate in that co-op. And so it's just a way to kind of get a greater economy of scale for them. Credit unions are consumer cooperatives in a way. There's a lot of energy cooperatives right now. The one I know best is in Connecticut, where you can sign up to be a member of the energy co-op. REI, the camping equipment company, is a consumer co-op. Green Bay Packers is a consumer co-op. Yeah, they're owned by... And this is the thing. A lot of people think of the Green Bay Packers as, like, something that's owned by the community in Green Bay, and it's not really true. It's a corporation, and the shares are owned by customers who are fans. So they're, you know, they're... So I think of them as customers because they're fans. And they're not only... in Green Bay at all. They're all over the country. And also dairy, there's a lot of dairy companies or cooperatives like the Cabot brand. These are usually individual farmers who they're dairy processing cooperatives, and so the individual dairy farmers are members of the food processing cooperative. And so there's a lot of different kinds of this kind of customer ownership, but I think of them as kind of all the same kind of thing. So that's when you have a specific relationship to production. And then ownership by everybody is a kind of, it's only for us kind of really theoretical. We don't really see a lot of this. And it's mostly in kind of like, mostly in developing countries and stuff, that you see this sort of thing, like a lot of micro-enterprise lending programs, development programs in the third world all kind of focus on community ownership of very small chunks of assets that people can make a living from. But I brought another handout, which is a story, which I think is this really great example of these people who I think formed a community co-op, but for... If they ever found out that I think that they started an anarchist project in their town, they'd be totally mortified. It's a story of this, it's this little town in Illinois, and it was like, this 1,000 people lived there. There was one grocery store that was owned by someone outside somewhere, and they were going to close the grocery store. And so the community said, well, we need a grocery store, and they wanted to keep it, and so they went and... they basically bought it out by selling shares to the people in the community, and just about everybody in the town bought a share in the corporation. Cooperatives are usually corporations, I should say, too, and formal co-ops anyway. And it's just a great, you know, when you look at this picture of this guy on the front, it's like, I don't know, it's just, that's the kind of guy that's, like, doing anarchism without even knowing it. And I think that's kind of cute. I just think he's a funny looking guy. So, but that's the kind of best example that I could find for like an American example of like the community. I guess it only really worked out because, I mean, this is not a perfect model of community ownership, you know, obviously at all, because It's not democratically controlled for one thing, but it's not necessarily owned just by the people in the community. People from the outside the community can also own shares in it. But it's the kind of closest idea that I could come up with. And so, does anybody have questions about my handout and my kind of distinctions between ownership by who and what's...
Can I actually get one of the first?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It reminds me of studies about how different communities manage common properties, like fisheries or water resources or things like that. But you can, you know, in some traditional settings, people have sustainably managed natural resources by making a sort of community control and setting up some sort of institution to control who has access to fishing when and keep it from overfishing and stuff like that. It's similar, and it probably has some of the same issues that you have to define who's in the community and who isn't and so forth.
That's one thing I deliberately didn't do here. I didn't tell you what kind of community is here, and that's a big kind of question. But there are, yeah, there are a lot of examples in developing countries about, it's usually natural resources. It's like common ownership of natural resources. You know, like the, a famous example was the water, the fight over the water in Cochabamba, Bolivia. And they, you know, they won for a time, you know, community control over the water that was going to be privatized.
There was a really elaborate system of control of water access in part of Spain for hundreds of years before the economy that became capitalist. There was a small hierarchy of sort of judicial roles assigning who gets to drain off water for their crops at what time and so forth.
Yeah.
But I mean, it worked for hundreds of years without too much conflict.
Did anybody else have any questions about that so far? Or comments? Yeah.
You know what? Like, what percentage of the economy these kind of cooperative businesses that you're, you know, more conventional cooperative businesses that you're describing make up? Like,
I don't know about percentage of the economy. I don't remember really the numbers, but the... I did look it up recently. The National Cooperative Business Association claims that there's some outlandish number of businesses and people who are a member of some kind of cooperative in one way or another. I mean, they said, I'm just kind of throwing this out there because I don't really remember the number, but I think they said something like in the U.S. there's like 50,000 different cooperatives, and like I don't even know how many people they said that represents. So it is really widespread, and especially in rural areas too, there's a lot of these agricultural cooperatives that a lot of farmers and stuff belong to.
I'll take part we're running a survey last year in Pennsylvania, and there's an estimated we have $405 million in gross revenues by cooperatives in Pennsylvania. So if one could estimate that perhaps across the country, like perhaps a little here and there, you can pretty much guess that it's pretty widespread.
Yeah.
So does that, I mean, is that making any sort of, is that changing at all? Like what happens to the, you know, the surplus value from the production these businesses are doing? Is it, I don't know. I mean, I guess how much this DC is like a really progressive development?
I was really surprised when I saw how many cooperatives they thought that there were and like the number of people that they said belonged to cooperatives, because it feels like a really small and marginal thing. I don't, I don't know. I mean, I think that we'll kind of like get to that question and kind of evaluating the different models, because I haven't really decided what I think about a lot of these things. Are you okay? So let me just like go back over this, you know, the list about things you don't like about capitalism, because I want to use them to look at these and say, well, does this model fix what we didn't like about capitalism? In a lot of places it doesn't. The biggest thing that we care about is like the exploitation of workers. And I kind of think that that's really the only thing that worker ownership really does well. In terms of like preventing this, like, tendency towards growth and accumulation and overrunning all the natural resources and everything, it doesn't really seem like worker cooperatives, that there's inherently anything built into them that that prevents that. Like, a worker co-op, you know, the people in the co-op are motivated by wanting to employ themselves, and so they're motivated by wanting to make money for the co-op, and so they will go out if they, you know, if they need to, they will go, there's no reason why they wouldn't go out and, like, make the same kind of garbage, the junk and trinkets that people are so busy making in a lot of places, that if they want to employ themselves and they want to have control over their own work, it's not built into the model that they care so much about the product. The product is not necessarily close to their hearts, although co-op people, you know, usually when you start a worker cooperative, you're doing it voluntarily and you do it because you have something that's, but as a general model for organizing the economy, I don't think it's really built in, and maybe other people have opinions about that. But so just kind of going down the list, so like the exploitation of workers, the trend towards growth, the limiting products to people who can pay for them, it seems like I wanted to, for worker ownership, I wanted to highlight just those few things. The other thing that worker co-ops don't do well is that they kind of, they extend democracy to people who spend their time as workers making stuff that other people pay for. But there's a lot of people whose primary responsibility is providing things that don't get paid for. And in the whole kind of idea of worker ownership, people like that get left out of the decision-making power. So things like, you know, taking care of children, which is often not paid for, and taking care of a household, are things that people don't usually get paid for unless you're doing it for somebody else's household. And it doesn't really, and if you kind of put your decision-making power in the hands of the people who are producers, and you define producer as someone who sells the things that they produce for money, then you're actually kind of limiting. And I think this is a kind of common criticism of people who really believe in worker co-ops as, like, the model and the way to go. Did you have your end?
On the question of, like, overproduction of unnecessary goods and sustainability and community control, one of the suggestions that I've seen on the trying to manage that is, I believe it was Michael Albert who suggested some sort of, like, creating these iterative councils that would manage between, like, consumer cooperatives and workers' cooperatives, and somehow, like, agree on, like, what should be produced and how to manage that effort. And to me, that sounded like it might be a compromise, but it seemed like that process might be sort of burdensome and cumbersome. And I wasn't quite sure how that would actually work, and whether that would really be effective, or whether it would just be a mismatch of, like, you know, new bureaucracy. And the second thing I wanted to possibly is the Ithaca Hours program and Ithaca, like creating alternative currencies. And how could that relate to, like, workers' cooperatives and keeping community control?
I think the thing about negotiating between different kinds of co-ops is what I wanted to get to after. I kind of want to look at the other two models based on our evaluation, but that's exactly what I'm going to come to. And I guess maybe I'm just going to go through the other parts first before we do that. And the Ithaca Hours I think are great, and I think that an economy based on hours of labor as the basis for exchange is really great. And I especially think it's, like, really interesting for kind of international trade, and right now we're limited to doing that only on the local level because it's not illegal to print money in a local place, but you can't, like, use it to trade between states. And I think that's another subject too, and maybe I think it's a whole nother workshop.
I was just thinking in terms of
local currencies tend to like keep the wealth within the community and more based upon community control, as opposed to letting it like flow elsewhere, and how that might be a way to like perhaps like influence what production decisions are made, and perhaps limit overproduction by like not financing unnecessary production.
Okay, so it sounds like you're talking about local currencies as a way of okay. Yeah.
I guess we'll call it cooperative fiscal policy.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's one of the things that we're talking about, is like, what does it mean to be the owner of something, and what does it mean to be the owner of resources? And only part of it is to actually have your name on the certificate of ownership of the thing. The other part of it is having democratic control over it, and those things don't always go together. So I think that, like, community control of capital markets is one of those things that we probably want, but I think we have to talk it over more. I'm going to go just kind of touch on some of the evaluation criteria for the other two models. What do you think about that? Okay? Okay. So consumer co-ops... get kind of a bad rap because people know of them as, like, you know, organic food co-ops that mostly, like, rich white people end up shopping at, and that's actually a pretty good criticism because, I mean, one thing they do is, like you were saying, like, they probably discourage overconsumption and overproduction because the motive of the people who own it is to provide something that they need. Whereas in a capitalist system, when the owners are motivated by profit, that motivation translates into trying to convince people that they need things that they don't, just so they'll buy them and prop up the economy and stuff. But if the motive for the people who own is to produce something that they want or need, then that probably, I think, discourages that kind of overconsumption. But the problem is like when you in this sort of model, it ends up being that the only people who are able to organize and get the things that they need are the people who have, you know, the time and money to put into the co-op in the first place. And that's why we get all these kind of, you know, yuppie food co-ops that, you know, only rich people can afford to eat organic food. So in a way, so it's kind of, there's, you know, good and bad things about this too. And the other thing about consumer co-ops that people criticize a lot is that there's no reason why they won't exploit their workers, except that they tend to be kind of, you know, like I belong to a food co-op and the people who work there seem pretty miserable a lot of the time, and they, you know, I think they treat them pretty shitty in a lot of ways. And there's nothing, so all I'm saying is that a lot of times, like, the employees of a customer-owned co-op, you know, may be treated well. There's nothing inherent in the model that says that they will be treated better. Yeah.
What do you mean by treated better? It seems to be a you know, laden with values. Do you mean, like, you know, they treat them better because they have access to the means of production, or because they pat them on the back and give them recognition?
I mostly mean that they pay them well, and that they create, a safe and safe working environment that kind of gives them an opportunity to, I don't know, to feel good about their work in some way.
Consumer co-ops, in this way are often driven, you know, to keep their own bottom line low, to keep their own prices of the foods that they're buying cheap, and they're organized in a hierarchical fashion. So by keeping the bottom, wanting to keep the bottom line low, they keep wages low, and it's organized in a hierarchical fashion, so the common employee doesn't have any decision-making power within the cooperative. So they're making low wages, and they have no power over their jobs.
Yeah. Okay, so quickly I'll go through the thing about community cooperatives, too, and what I think of as a community cooperative is really, like, the thing that I always forget the term for, the Bookchin stuff. all that. So a couple of highlights from the evaluation criteria of community co-ops is that it's it's the same kind of thing. Like, there's nothing inherent that says if a community gets together, if this Washburn Foods was owned by everybody in the community and they decide that they still need to hire people to work there, there's no built-in reason that they will treat the workers any better than any kind of capitalist firm would, except that the people, who work there are part of the community, and if it's democratically controlled, participate in the decisions. But that's not... I don't know. That may be true or maybe not. I think in a community cooperative, it probably also handles allocation a lot better, which is the stuff that Michael Albert loves to talk about, too. And this whole concept of, like, you know, if you're only going on worker co-ops or consumer co-ops, something like childcare, which is an education of children and stuff that is necessary for the whole community. Like, one thing that I think is that young people without children should care about children and how they get treated, because they're part of your community and they're part of your future. And just because you're not a parent and just because you're not a teacher or a child care provider doesn't mean that you shouldn't be caring about children. And so I kind of think that that this kind of community ownership model gets at some of those things that that even if you don't have a direct relationship to what's going on there, it's still in your interest that it happens. A community ownership is more likely to be more environmentally friendly, just only for the same reason, again, because you're more likely to be living in the area. You don't want to pollute your own yard. So it's only to the extent that this is, like, really local decision-making that we're talking about. I guess that was all the points that I wanted to make about that. The next thing I'm going to do after this is kind of make some suggestions and ask for a discussion on kind of ways that you can combine models or ways that you can separate out models and stuff. But before I do that, does anybody want to, add anything to what I said or have any questions? Yeah.
Well, this is just sort of a concern. It's not particularly well formulated, but I guess all these models sort of really don't strike me as being outside of capitalism. And I'm wondering if, I guess for the purpose of this exercise, like, and this is actually sort of a question that I have in general, because I'm part of a co-op, a pretty good one. Like, we accept food stamps, there's sliding scale, so it's good in terms of being a lot more conscious and putting effort into making it something that more people can participate in and have access to. And I think that that's pretty exciting, but I just sort of question, like, the importance of co-ops and, like, their value as a political project, or, I mean, I guess it's more of a social project, it's an economic one, but, like, a way to, just something to put our time into. And so I wonder if, when we're talking about ideals, I guess I just think, I don't know, like, maybe we need to think, like, strategically about it, or maybe they'll be different according to, like, what goal you're trying to accomplish. Because since all these co-ops really do seem to be, like, within capitalism, to me, like, to me, none of these, I can't really envision any of these being what, like, in my utopia, my ideal anarchism, like, what I would envision. Although I think that cooperativeness is part of a lot of people's anarchist vision, so I'm just sort of interested in if people have more ideas about that and talking about that, because I'm interested in hashing it out more, because I don't know, my decision is not, like, made or whatever, where I stand on this, but, like, just how important co-ops are, and whether co-ops are a transitional project, what kinds of co-ops are actually useful, what kinds of co-ops just, you know, make your life better because you can have, you know, tamari almonds for cheap, but, like, and what kinds actually, like, you know, are part of, like, a real project, and what are utopian and what are sort of transitional visions and that kind of stuff. I'd be really interested in that, if you or anybody else here had any.
Should we open that to discussion? Do you want to
discussion? Yeah, do you want to answer?
Yeah, in my experience and my thinking with co-ops is that they are a transitional thing, and that especially worker co-ops are sort of a way to get people to start thinking about worker control and about how to work together in, like, a communal space. And And you know, of course, they exist within capitalism, and that is a good point that they don't have boundaries on consumption. I think, but when you start getting into community-controlled cooperatives, then you often, a lot of community-controlled cooperatives begin to exist outside of a monetary system, and that it becomes a barter sort of situation or a project that's undertaken for the better of the community, such as, like, community, you know, if you have a my ideal, my, like, utopian anarchist vision is a coalition of community cooperatives that are coexisting outside of a monetary economy. So, you know, you have a child care co-op that you can get free child care at, and the folks that are into child care can, you know, work there when they want to, and then, you know, down the road you have a blacksmith community, a cooperative blacksmith shop that you can, you know, show up at, and everybody does what they sort of want to do. So I think community co-ops they don't function well in capitalism, and they function pretty well in, like, a utopian anarchist vision, provided they're not, you know, you've gotten rid of a monetary economy at that point. So, but worker and consumer co-ops, just, they're sort of transitional. Consumer co-ops being, I've never really found much of a use for them. In my own.
I don't know, those really cheap tamari almonds.
Except for those cheap tamari almonds, but, you know, yeah, you know, except that, I mean, that they sometimes provide local control of local ownership is a good thing, but, you know, so does in a small local health food store. Like, you know, consumer co-ops don't do it for me.
The subject that I'm trying to really focus on is really this question of ownership, who owns and what is their motivation for doing it. And I think that there's, you know, there's like a long list of other kinds of questions when we're going to talk about, like, you know, utopian model of, you know, production and consumption. And there's a lot of other things that we're going to want to talk about, you know, things like the hours-based economies and things like abolishing money altogether. And there's loads of different kinds of topics, and I actually thought about trying to include more of them, but I thought it might be too ambitious for the hour. But it's all really interesting, and one thing that I have done in preparing this is really kind of assume that we're still talking about money as exchange, and we're talking about still a kind of idea of someone owning, even if it's everybody. And the other thing is that you're right, that I think that, and this is one of the things, like, in my work, that I help create cooperatives for a living, and this is one thing that we're running into, is, like, so we've got these cooperatives, and they're supposed to be, you know, they're democratically run and everything, but they still exist in a capitalist economy, so, you know, so we have to talk about competition and, you know, who your market is and what your strategy is for all this stuff. And, like, whenever you talk about worker co-ops or consumer co-ops, you're only talking about the business and what goes on inside it. You're not talking about what goes on in the space between them. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the space between them. There's, you know, institutions now, like loan funds and stuff, where cooperatives weren't able to get financing before. Now there are, like, you know, like equity markets for co-ops, which are, like, don't know yet what I think about that. It's like, you know, it's kind of spreading ownership and control of capital to more people and directing it at cooperatives, but nobody asks me to vote on anything about it, so I'm kind of worried about that. Yeah.
I just wonder if you've taken, I don't know how much I agree with it, as far as, like, sort of the ultra-left argument that, you know, anything from a trade union to a cooperative to any sort of dual power is, like, just absolutely useless until you have that social breakdown of decomposition of capital to a point of, like, revolutionary rupture, or otherwise it'll just be consumed by capitalism, which I think the argument could be made for cooperatives certainly and trade unions as well, but I don't know, work that into a critique.
I was having a discussion with somebody about this very thing, and, like, you know, are co-ops a transitional strategy, or are they a model of what we're trying to build, and this other person was saying, too, that at least cooperatives are a kind of training ground, you know, for what's going to come in that time in the future, which I'm trying to actually let go of that idea in many parts of my life right now, that time in the future when everything's going to be great. But I've come to think of it as a kind of, so there's this kind of our co-ops, you know, training ground for the revolution, our co-ops and other, you know, forms of positive social structures, the revolution in themselves, you know. I think either way, I'm okay with that. I don't really feel like I need to answer that question, because either way it means I want to do it. So, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I appreciate the criticisms too, but I agree. I think it is ways to self-organize and teach people how to organize themselves and actually aspire for things in the future, so I don't think it's like a wasted cause.
I have another comment that just made me think of something that I spent some time in the Czech Republic, and a lot of people told me that a problem with their economy was that they'd gone directly from this total command economy where people relied on the state to plan everything for them to this, like, you know, radical free market transformation over the course of a year, and there was no culture of, you know, entrepreneurship and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, while people were sort of figuring out what the hell capitalism was, all these capitalists from other countries, like mostly from Italy, I guess, came in and, you know, took over the whole economy. So I think it's the same thing with some sort of, like, you know, anarchist or socialistic economy. Like, if you just went directly to that, I don't know, and you didn't have any pre-existing culture of, you know, mutual aid and cooperative decision-making and stuff like that, it might not, you know, you might be less likely to get that revolution in the first place, and it might be sort of dysfunctional afterwards. But that's just sort of a random thought I had listening to Mark. But I was just wondering, you made a reference to Mondragon, and I've heard other people refer to that, but nothing more specific than it's this town where everything's a co-op. So I was wondering what's really going on there, and whether, you know, what ways it's working.
Well, actually, things are... they're doing all sorts of crazy things there now. And it's in Spain, in the Basque region. It's a whole series of worker cooperatives, and they're very kind of industrial. They started out mostly with appliances, big appliances, and it's a huge, you know, part of the economy. The way that it was able to grow and develop was it had a lot of these, you know, institutions in between the space between the co-ops. Like, it had a big cooperative bank that everybody put their money into, and a lot of other just kinds of supportive structures for the cooperatives that made it into whole cooperative economy, not just individual co-ops existing in a competitive economy. And so it grew, and it got really big, and then lately, they've just been doing some really fucked up things. They basically, like, when the European Union was forming, they felt really threatened by globalization of capital, and now they've become a multinational corporation, and they have production facilities in the third world where they employ people. And those people are not employed by a cooperative. They're regular capitalist firms. And the people in Spain are profiting from them. And so it's completely fucked. And so there's, and the thing is about, one of the things I think I didn't say about worker co-ops is that there's kind of this theory that cooperatives don't have a propensity for growth, because the interest of the worker is to retain control over the business. And in order to do that, they have an incentive to keep it small. And also, there are people who think that worker ownership has built-in mechanisms for preventing growth for growth's sake. But this Mondragon experiment is like, maybe it's telling us that that's not true. Because they grew so big that they totally abandoned all of their ideals, and I don't even know how they're even justifying it, what they're doing. Yeah.
I guess in talking about the effectiveness of co-ops and them as a training ground for later things is the worker co-op that I helped organize and that I participated in, it was a group of activists that we wanted to... basically what we do is we do, like, marketing for nonprofit groups. And so we wanted to, like, we knew we had to participate in capitalism. And so we wanted to do it in a minimal way. that may actually be something that, you know, will make a positive effect on social change and in, you know, bringing about a revolution. So we do like marketing, like mostly web work and like database work for nonprofits, and then overcharge them and take that money and allow us to do free marketing for like grassroots radical groups. And we do a lot of independent media center work. And so what we did is, you know, we want to come together and do this so we could exist and have money to be activists in a sort of a harmless way, if not a proactive way. And so we found a worker cooperative model to be the most effective way to do that. You know, it's like we started with a group of really good people and with like really good ideas, and a standard hierarchical model of a corporation wasn't going to work. And so so in that context, the worker-owned model was our best option, because it gave us, you know, it gave us worker control and, you know, one member, one vote sort of decision-making processes and consensus decision-making processes. So it did have its role in that way. It's not checked consumption, of course, but I think that deals with what you're trying to do with the worker-owned cooperative. Like, if you're out to make appliances, you're gonna get fucked. You know, like, yeah, you're just gonna grow and get too big. But if you're out to, you know, just like funnel money into underground movements by like ripping off liberals, then so it's like depends on what you want to do, I guess.
Is that in the mission statement for the group?
Oh yeah.
Put it right on the front door.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Brochure.
Okay, so yeah.
Where does community support agriculture fall into that co-op model? I'm just thinking of where is that a. I guess it's sort of a consumer co-op, but yeah. But I don't know. It seems to me to be a little bit more functional and good than other models. I've been involved in a CSA farm for the last few months, and I've been trying to pretty unsuccessfully thinking of like what lessons that has for the larger economy. So I don't know if anyone else has had any thoughts along those lines. But food might just sort of be a special case. I don't know.
That's a it's a consumer co-op, but the ones I'm familiar with around the Bay Area and California, that the it's very worker controlled.
Right.
So it's very different than the model of the store where the people just come in and they're employees, because the workers in that case, they make all the decisions pretty much. So. It's exceptional.
I think part of it is that, you know, the workers on a CSA have really special skills that not a lot of people have, whereas the workers in a lot of, like in a shop, you know, are fairly easily replaced in a place with a lot of people, so there's not the same sort of relationship. There's not, sort of a check and a balance in a CSA. So, I don't know.
One thing that, about a lot with cooperatives, especially worker cooperatives. And I definitely agree that they're not only a form of training ground, but also a form of dual power. But it's how to ensure that throughout time they'll be radical and stay radical and have a political analysis and almost like an attachment to social movement. Again, they say it with the Mondragon. Like if you look at the history of Mondragon, the beginning of it was pretty right on, and then as it just grew or whatever happened, it kind of just, you know, went from liberal to, I would say, just really capitalist in a lot of ways. And you see that a lot. Like, all the cooperatives that I've been involved with have had that sort of, like, shift or, like, you know, since this is like, large revolving door of membership and things like that, almost like the mission statement or, like, the sort of political theory and development of the group kind of changes over time, too. And like, somehow that's really good, and some reasons that's kind of bad. And I think, like, what gets me is that sometimes the whole, like, purpose of it kind of changes, and it really loses this whole, like, alternative to capitalism and critique of capitalism, sort of. So I don't know if you really thought about that or like, how to deal with that sort of process within a cooperative to maintain that radical edge again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of cooperatives don't even have it. And a lot of cooperatives, like, there's this one, I forget what it's called, there's this cooperative I've met, it's like a high-tech company that makes something. I can't even tell you what it is. It's about this big, and it's really pretty, and it's got something to do with lasers or something. But it's basically like these, and they're all, you know, these kind of middle-aged, super geeky guys who are starting this new company. It's a high-tech company. They want to make a lot of money, and they decided they can make more money if it's a cooperative. And so there's all these kind of micro and macro issues, too, because the other thing I was going to respond to what you said was that the whole thing about Mondragon, like, we were saying that when they were producing mostly for domestic consumption in their own region, they were able to create these kind of supportive structures around the cooperatives that really turned it into a cooperation-based economy. But then once they're forced to compete in the global economy, they didn't have the same kind of support structures, and I think that's what kind of sold them out. Maybe it's like, do we need now global support structures for cooperatives? And I mean, that's pretty big. I don't know. And that's really hard. You're talking about international finance.
Well, even just around the decision-making in the Mondragon, like, they definitely have a union busting campaign and everything like that, and it shows, like, the shift from decision-making from the workers up to, like, management. Mm-hmm. I think that's, like, another key of how to maintain that sort of, like, control, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of go back to where I was going to end up, and that was, like, trying to get the best of all worlds. And you guys were starting to get at that. Like, you know, how can you have a CSA, which is, I think it's a co-op. I think it's an informal co-op because you own shares in the farm. And in a cooperative, it's a corporation, and then you're a shareholder in the corporation. But a CSA just isn't, like, formalized like that most of the time. You own a share, but it's informal. But how can you combine the benefits of being customer-owned with the benefits of being worker-controlled? And that's kind of the thing. And you get into issues of ultimate accountability and who's, if there's a really important decision to make and people have, you know, the customers could have a conflict with the workers and who's, you know, who decides. Or there's a few ways that people have dealt with this. There are hybrid co-ops right now, which have both models of ownership built in. They're both customer co-ops and worker co-ops. An Equal Exchange Coffee Company is one of these. Part of its ownership structure is that it's owned by its member cooperatives. So its members are also the coffee farmers that supplied the coffee to the company. So they themselves are cooperatives, but then Equal Exchange is a cooperative of those co-ops. It's a marketing and processing and distribution co-op. But it's also part of the ownership model is also worker ownership. So I don't know exactly what the breakdown is on their books, but it's like a certain percentage is owned by the workers, a certain percentage is owned by the customers who are the coffee farmers. Another way to kind of deal with this and trying to reconcile these is just to say that, you know, like my little circles and how I have some people are customers and some are workers and sometimes they overlap is just to make them all the same thing. Customers are the workers, and there's nobody who's a worker who's not a customer, and there's nobody a customer who's not a worker. And that's only going to work in certain situations. So an example that could work for is there's a child care co-op in Jamaica Plain that I think is organized on this model. So it's owned by the customers who are the parents who need the child care for the kids, but I don't think that they employ a child care provider. It's just that they rotate jobs. So everybody who's a customer is a worker, and everybody who's a worker is a customer. And so that way you take away this kind of, you know, possible conflict. And then the other thing that I think about a lot is, like, is the community kind of focus. Community ownership model that builds in worker participation. And there's a lot of ways that you can do this. You can separate out what kind of decisions there are to make. You know, not all decisions are the same. And, you know, maybe some decisions are most appropriately left to the workers, and some decisions really need more input from the community, and I think that's something that we probably already agree on a lot. There may be different kinds of products that lend themselves well to one kind of model or another. I haven't really thought about what is a product that's good for a worker co-op, what's a product that's good for a community co-op. But there could be, you know, maybe different models of ownership are just different, are just more appropriate for different industries. And then this kind of idea of community control of the labor markets. He's not here, but I was talking to a guy here who told me about this idea that I hadn't heard about. I work with a group of cooperatives, all of who own shares of their own cooperative. And his suggestion was that, he was saying that you still have a lot of risk there as an owner, especially when it's a small co-op like the ones that I work with. If the company goes under, you lose not only your source of income, but you lose whatever wealth you had accumulated in the co-op as well. His suggestion was that all of the people who are in all of the co-ops that I work with could kind of collectivize their ownership of the capital of all the cooperatives and kind of all own a share of each other's cooperatives, which is a way of like spreading around the risk and create a more collective model. So those are some ways that I know of kind of combining the best of all worlds here, and that's the end of my list, and so I want to see where you want to go with that.
It's interesting. I've never heard that sort of share, like sharing, collectivizing of shares. One thing that I've always heard a lot about, and sometimes I'm mixed with it, about just having a share, like in a co-op, and having that model, is that like once investing in the co-op, you have not only like a personal interest, but also an economic interest to make sure that the cooperative keeps running. And I wonder if like having a collectivized share would lessen that sort of idea. Again, like I'm not so sure that's always like a great incentive, but.
I think that there's like this International Cooperative Alliance that has this list of cooperative principles, and one of them that people have the most difficult time with is the cooperation among cooperatives, because there's nothing really, there aren't any formal built-in ways of enforcing it. It's all voluntary, and so like doing business with other cooperatives is voluntary, and a lot of cooperatives won't do business with another cooperative just because they're a co-op. They would just do what any other business would do. They go to whoever will give them the cheapest price. And so this thing of like, you know, sharing capital ownership, which in a way is not much different from like just community ownership, it kind of gives you an interest in everybody else's success too. And so that's a way of kind of institutionalizing cooperation among cooperatives.
I'm wondering if anyone here has studied the kibbutz model, because I think it'd be really informative to understand why it has failed. Currently, you know, the kibbutzes in Israel are becoming more and more commercialized, and they're turning just into like mini industries that like make stuff, but they no longer have that sense of, you know, community and like, you know, I'd say like the goal has been corrupted by the pressures of capitalism, like in the larger, you know, the larger world, and it's really hard to go off and say, okay, we're going to create like our little, you know, perfect community. We're going to have our CSA. We're going to do whatever, because inevitably, like after a certain amount of time, or you know, after it gets big enough, it confronts like this larger picture, which it's, you know, directly opposing, like opposite to, and it can't really jive together. So, you know, I'm wondering if anyone knows anything about that, perhaps.
Also, just quickly, two things I think really affected that is one, kibbutzes in Israel are really tied up with like nationalist fervor and like general almost Zionist like sort of like creates like, you know, sustainable thing, and so I think that's part of it. And so the second thing is that you notice in general group dynamics, when you usually start something, you use it with a small group of like people very familiar with each other. The relationships are very fluid, very, very dynamic, and it's based around the ideas of what I formed it. As it go on and enlarges, you tend to sort of more like rationalize your decision process and create this like more overarching structures, and sort of like lose sight of the goals you started with, and then the forces like can move in and they will sort of like disregard the actual nature of it and move more toward a corporate model.
Not knowing a lot about this, just aside from generally how the Israeli economy seems to work. I think that now, you know, these kibbutzes that used to be the backbone of the economy are competing with, you know, corporate farms that have really low-wage immigrant work on them, and, you know, factories that are more like sweatshops and stuff like that. So I think that's basically it, is that Israel didn't have a developed capitalist economy 50 years ago, but now it does. So they were based in agriculture, and Israeli agriculture is more along with the U.S. model now.
I think by having cooperatives maintain economic ties with each other, I think that's a good way of keeping a sort of political identity and focus towards a cooperative movement. But I also think, like, I don't know, I look at it two different ways. Like, is it like the people who are working within the cooperatives or actually a part of it, is it like, is that the best place to keep it radical or to keep it an identification of the cooperative movement, or should it be an institutional thing? Like, obviously I'd like to have it both, but like, I don't know, definitely one cooperative that I was in, which was service-based, a restaurant, one way really for us who wanted to keep it more, basically make it more radical, more politically focused, was to really recruit or like hire people, basically, who had a more cooperative understanding, as opposed to just hiring people who were just really good in a restaurant, you know what I mean? And it definitely becomes hard because in order to stay open, you need to produce a good product. Fortunately, in the capitalism, that's where the capitalist pressure comes in. But at the same time, if you want to become a cooperative, not just a regular restaurant, you need to have workers who understand that. And it's definitely like give and take, like, you know, the education, the workplace, and all those other things too. But I think it's definitely a responsibility of people who work within the cooperative to make sure that they have ties with other cooperatives. Again, I think that's a really good idea, though, to have shares in other cooperatives and maintain an economy that way.
There's a lot of talk in co-op people about what should be your strategy, you know, when you hire a new person in the co-op. And people just, every business just kind of looks at it differently. Like, there are some who, like, really say that they want co-op people in their co-ops and that they'll train them on whatever skills of whatever the co-op is doing, but they need to understand co-op principles. And there are others, like the Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco. They're not a consumer co-op, they're a worker co-op, and they actually say that they don't want any co-op people. They're like, you know, once you're here, you'll become a co-op person, but we don't want you to start that way, because co-op people can be really geeky and obnoxious. and it can be difficult people to work with. And so, but the process of, like, of, like, being in the co-op also, like, does tend to radicalize people. Like, the thing that I was telling you about the people who make those pretty little things, all those guys, like, when I was talking to them, it really seemed like they were kind of coming around to all this idea. Like, they had been working in this co-op for years and had always thought of it as, like, the best way for them to get rich. And they were, like, really, really thinking about all of their kind of democratic practices internally, and the more they thought about it, the more they came to the most rational, to the most radical conclusions, because those are the right ones. And it's just kind of an interesting thing to watch, that the participation in a co-op does radicalize people, and I think every business just works out that problem for themselves. We're out of time. Mm-hmm. So if nobody else has anything else, then I guess we're done.
I remember there's this guy I know. There's this student at the University of Oxford named Yuri Gordon, who's from Israel, who's doing his PhD dissertation on cooperative and direct democracy in Israel. And I'll try to get you his contact if we might about that. He's doing some really interesting stuff on that.
Stacey, you work with helping draft the rules and regulations for cooperatives, or
what I do is not I do I'm a technical assistance provider for co-ops, so I help with everything, but my clients are people. My organization sees worker co-ops as a poverty alleviation strategy, so all the people that we work with are poor women, all immigrant and refugee women of color. And so technical assistance for me is a whole, is much more kind of holistic. So a regular technical assistance provider would be talking about, you know, your incorporation and your bylaws and your structure about allocating profits and stuff and trying to make sure that there are profits or at least that there are not losses. I do all of that, but I also, you know, try to make sure their kids don't get deported and help them with their English and all sorts of stuff like that. So, okay, I think that's it.